Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie.
Joining me now in studio, I'm delighted to say, is one of the great American novelists. He didn't set out to be a writer, but went on to become a Pulitzer Prize winning novelist, best known for his Frank Bascom novels. So now you know who it is. It is, of course, Richard Ford. Good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning, David. Nice to see you.
Listen, the fact that we're getting a fifth Frank Bascom novel, I suppose, is a boost, because I had thought it had ended with the trilogy. But
me
this
too.
Is five books. Richard Ford, 36 years, and you have taken us on a remarkable journey with this character, Frank Bascom. What is it about this character, who is in many respects deeply flawed and imperfect, that people are so attracted to?
Well, I think if from my point of view, from the guy who's writing it, it's that he's talking about things that are deadly serious to him, the death of his son in the case of this book, but also that he's funny at the same time. And there's this old Borscht Belt chestnut which says, if nothing's funny, nothing's serious. And that's kind of the way I go at these books, and it's the way I go at the world. I think he's that for one thing. Beyond that, you know, I don't know. You know, you send a book off into the world, you do your best, you hope that people will read all of it, read all the words. And once they read all the words, what they like about it is impenetrable to me.
You sort of lose custody once.
And you should. I mean, there's an old notion that you know, a book is not finished until it leaves the hands of the person who made it. And that's fine with me. I mean, if you read all my book, you can think anything you want.
What struck me about it is that Be Mine, which is the fifth installment, it returns Frank Bascom to a place where we sort of find him in the very, very first place. He's facing the prospect of the death of a son, except now he's in his 70s. The son that has this illness is 47. And what you just said there, it shouldn't be funny, because in many ways it's a tragedy. But you take Frank and Paul, this father and son, on a road trip, and it's full of unflinching comedy. As well as that heartbreak, there's conflict and there's love.
Yes. Well, I mean, I don't know how one faces death. I've seen a lot, at my age, obviously, I've seen people face death. But I would like to think that if I were going to face death, this would be my natural mode. I would try to find something interesting about it, and I would try to find something that's a laugh about it, because the other alternative is just, to me, unacceptable. I mean, I saw my parents die, I saw my grandparents die. They were quite, remember my mother said to me, she said, my chances are slim and none. My mother was quite hard bit, and I thought to myself, ooh, ow. You know, and I thought, I'm going to be different from that, I hope. And so that's what I'm doing, I suppose. I'm projecting something.
It's interesting, because this is not Frank and Paul's first road trip. Independence Day, which for which you won the Pulitzer, was also about a road trip between the same troubled son and their father. And this time they're off to Mount Rushmore, and it's coming up to Valentine's Day. What is it about that notion of transience that you are attracted to, and this kind of, because when we think of America, we think of those great big road trips.
Well, one thing is that you get two people and stick them in a car, and then it ups the level of drama. It ups the intensity of what's going on between them. So that's certainly one thing. Also, not being a great plotter in books, I've never thought that was my great strength. If you put somebody in a car and send them someplace, you have a kind of plot built in there. So that I suppose.
And also they're trapped in a small space, so they have to engage.
And it's also part of the American ethos of people leaving the East and going toward the West. And even though you might think that that's not true of this book, that it taps into that ethos, I think in a way it does.
Yeah. And what really struck me about it, because obviously, and I don't want to give away the final outcome.
Ahead,
I don't want to, because it's so delicious. But Paul is, the son, is suffering from Lou Gehrig's disease. It's ALS. And what really struck me is, as well as about the conversation that this father and son have, is what's left unsaid. So particularly with Frank's observations about his son, about how his son's condition is debilitating, whether it's muscle spasms or the changes he's observing, that is unsaid but maybe speaks volumes.
Well, I mean, you can't just have a father and son who, underlying all, love each other, just driving across the country talking about the grimness of the symptoms of ALS, which are inexorable and various. I mean, you have to find something else to say, as one would if you were going to do that. I mean, he's doing this as a gesture of affection, and the son is mirthful by nature and a little bit eccentric and unexpectable. And so I was drawing a bit from Independence Day, the kind of young kid that Paul was then, and trying to say what kind of man would he have made of himself. And so it seemed consonant to have him be this kind of irreverent, unpredictable, again, eccentric kind of man.
And a bit also, almost a little bit childlike, when they go to the Corn Palace and Paul is just sort of fascinated by this.
You say the word Corn Palace, but do you have any idea what the Corn Palace
no.
is?
Well, only from your description of it, but...
Well, it's in Mitchell, South Dakota, and it's in essence, now a civic auditorium in the middle of this Corn Belt town in the middle of South Dakota, and it's an edifice made completely, literally, of corn on the outside, the exterior, and it gets changed every year. And it's the zaniest thing imaginable. Though at some time in American history, there were more than one of them. Now it's called the world's only Corn Palace because it's the only one extant. So, but it's a sort of, an homage to Demeter. It's an homage to the land. It's an homage to fecundity, but it's very bizarre.
Yeah.
One of the hardest things in the world for me to do as a writer is to describe something that has no correlatives anywhere else. There is no other Corn Palace, and so you're sort of stuck with, as a writer, saying to the reader, "Now you're not going to get this, but I'm going to somehow, with sentences, make this available to you."
Yeah, it was such a beautifully, such a vivid picture of it.
I'm glad to know that. That doesn't disappoint me at all, by the way.
Yeah, I want one of those key rings.
I'll see you get one.
You see, I get a corn key ring. when we first met Frank Bascombe, he was in early middle age. Now he's 74. He is his son's caregiver, but by virtue of his own age and maturity, he's contemplating his own age, his own mortality, and his happiness, because the book opens and ends with a sort of reflection on happiness.
Correct.
You're now what, seven? Can I say you're now 79?
You can certainly say that.
Yeah. Are you happy?
Yes, I am happy, but as I say to people, I was raised a Protestant, so it's possible I've never been happy. but you know what I'm talking about, don't you?
I do.
To me, happiness is something that you define for yourself. It's not, Christmas morning happy or Disneyland happy or ice cream cone happy. It's that you look around and you see, in my case, I married the girl I was in love with when I was 17. I've done the things that I wanted to do with my life up to now, writing these books. I haven't got sick yet. I haven't, all that stuff. So I look around and I think, yes. In fact, this is what happiness is to me. And it's not just a bunch of negatives that didn't fall due. It's that all in all, I think, yes. I would hate to actually be 79 years old and say that I wasn't happy. Yeah. But I think if I wasn't happy, you would know it. You probably wouldn't have asked me that question. But I think that, on the other hand, it's what people have to do when they get old. They have to, and I'm old. So you have to sort of say to yourself, I don't know how long I'm going to be here, but I'd like to think that I'm going to like it while I am.
Are you afraid of confronting mortality, or are you quite sanguine about that?
Oh, with bravado, I would like to be able to say, no, I'm not afraid of it at all. But I don't think you ever know that until you have to do it until the moment comes. So it doesn't matter what I think now. I might think something different if I have the, you never know how you're going to die. Maybe get hit, as Frank says, maybe get hit by a truck full of golf carts, or you may, who knows? So
who knows how?
I hope, it's probably the one thing in the world I hope about. I hope I'll meet those things with equanimity.
Yeah. Can I bring you back to Frank Bascom? Because I think these, and you return to him every decade or at least, and sometimes shorter. For me, your novels always sort of reflected the changing nature of American society and politics. You know, its hopes, its hypocrisies, what's working, what's not, those social and racial tensions. And that's one of, I suppose, one of the enduring fascinations of reading your books. Could you take us on that journey? Sometimes it's overt, sometimes it's quite subtle. But how do you feel about an America now that Ron DeSantis is challenging Donald Trump for the presidency and Joe Biden, who was here recently, is hoping to have another tilt at the White House?
Well, how I feel about it is, at this stage at least, all of those people who are in the mix to want to be our next president are following the template that the Constitution set out. That is to say, they're vying for the job, and that seems to me to be just great. It's not great when the president tries to create an insurrection and take the Capitol away and overturn the election. That's quite troubling to me. I don't know anything about DeSantis other than he seems mean to me and mean spirited and not a guy I would ever want to vote for, but. But I take a sanguine view that the institutions of election, the institutions of achieving office are being followed now. So that's fine. The other bit, you know, the bits, I mean, that the country is hugely divided in ways that are extremely troubling, and that a lot of the institutions that I rely on, that we all rely on, are being eroded severely, mostly by the right wing. Elections are being eroded. Registration to be able to vote is being eroded. The sanctity of public schools is being eroded. The Supreme Court is being eroded, but by the right. So that troubles me a lot. And I probably ain't going to be around when most of it comes to fruition. But it disturbs me greatly.
Yeah, the series has been a remarkable lens, I think, on American society for readers, as well as the political landscape. And maybe this is just me revealing the reason why I've enjoyed your books. But for me, Frank Bascom is fascinating because he gives us an insight into the mind of men. Not all men, of course, but it's a very distinct male gaze. It's about fathers and sons. It's about divorce. It's about men's place in the world.
No comment about that, really. I mean, I guess I think that the way men look at the world is a great deal like the way women look at the world and vice versa. So the male gaze actually doesn't mean anything to me. It's a hollow expression. I think it's a human gaze that I'm trying to do with these books. And I think that they can, and you are, if I might say, living proof of the fact that a woman can read this book and think it's speaking to her. Women can read this book and think it's relevant to whatever is going on in her life and mind. So it wouldn't ever be anything I would do to try to isolate a male gaze in a way from a woman's gaze. But as I said before, you're entitled to your view if you read the book. And if that's what you think, then you can't be wrong.
Absolutely not. But for me, it has been fascinating to do that. I've really enjoyed that, particularly your exploration of fathers and sons. I wanted just obviously recently we had the death of the great novelist Martin Amis.
My friend.
Yes, your friend. And I just wanted maybe just to ask you, first of all, a reflection on his work.
Well, he was a brilliant writer and he was a brilliant talker and a brilliant thinker and a brilliant reader. And to lose someone like that out of your generation, which is going to happen, is a real felt loss in my life. I mean, he was fearless in the things that he would write about. He was transgressive in the things that he would write about, trying to write a sympathetic book about a Nazi camp commander, for instance. Lost his publisher in France because of that. Lost a lot of things because of that. But, you know, he was a sweet and decent man. All this enfant terrible reputation that he carried from his youth, maybe, and I wasn't around then, but maybe that was true. But by the time I knew him, and we were in our late 40s, he was a colleague. He was genuine. He was direct and candid, generous, That's the part about him I'll miss a lot.
Yeah. One of the a debate that sort of pops up time and time again is the fact that women are doing so well in literary fiction, and some people will say, well, to the exclusion of the great male, you know, novelist, which perhaps, you know, during the 80s and perhaps 90s we would have seen that. Do you think there's any truth to that, or how do you see the dominance of women in literary fiction nowadays? Is it something you welcome?
I haven't noticed, actually. I think all boats rise on a rising tide, is what I think. If women who are writing fiction are doing well, then that's encouraging to me, not a woman. So I don't divide the world of writers among women and men. You know, I could be a little cynical and say that publishers, and probably it's not very cynical, that publishers see a market for this, and that's one of the reasons that not because they don't deserve it, they deserve it. But all these things are run by commerce, by and large. And if publishers are going around looking for women writers, they will find them because there's plenty of good ones out there.
There really are. In the wake, do you think in the wake of Me Too and other prominent social movements that writers are a little bit more cautious about the topics they engage in or how they engage with them, whether sexual relations or...
Well, yes, because publishing in the United States anyway, and I don't know what it's like in Ireland or in Britain, but we have to endure a sensitivity edit, which is to say somebody who is inevitably three generations younger than you are has to come along and read your book and tell you all the things in your book that are likely to offend someone. And while they don't lean on you in such a way as to force you to take things out, they do lean on you. And the way that they lean on you is to imply that, well, maybe marketing is not going to push this book as hard as it might push this book if you don't take this little word out or that passage. The only thing you can do is just to fight it like hell.
Yeah, because there's an interesting relationship that Frank Bascombe has in the novel with a masseuse of Vietnamese origin, and I thought it was vital to his personality and to the book. But you've never been tempted to self censor or anything like that. You fight for your stories.
I try to because I trust myself.
Yeah.
I thought when I wrote that passage about this Vietnamese masseuse that it was probably going to light some people up at the publishing house. But, the truth is, they didn't say anything.
So you didn't have to fight for it?
I didn't have to fight for that. Yeah. I had to fight for other things. A very funny thing that I had to fight for, I'll tell you, at the risk of alienating somebody out there, because you can't not alienate nobody. There's a passage in the book in which Frank is driving down the street in the middle of Rochester, Minnesota, in the middle of February, and he passes a sightless man, a blind man, walking along the street with his cane, wearing a pair of glasses, sort of Ray Charles glasses. And Frank says to the reader, he says, "We pass the blind man who is walking along, hoping that his next step will not be off the end of the earth."
Yeah.
And my editor said, "Ooh," she said, "well, you better think about that again," she said, "because it might suggest to people that a person who is blind is disabled." I said, "A person who is blind and sightless is disabled. They can't see. That is a disability. I'm not making fun of that person. I was just saying that's probably how I would feel if I was walking along the street, not able to see what was in front of me and afraid I might step in a hole." But I didn't change that.
Yes, you fought for that and you included it. The amount of your work is absolutely prolific. To talk to me about what was potentially in store for you had you not persisted with your writing. What was the original life plan?
Well, all my original life plans preceded that life plan. I'd been in the Marine Corps. That hadn't worked out. I'd been to law school. That hadn't worked out. I taught grade school. That hadn't worked out. A lot of things hadn't worked out for me by the time I was 23. And I remember my wife was sitting in my mother's bedroom. We were actually packing our bags to go on our honeymoon in a couple of days. And she sort of looked at me and she said, typical of what you think a young wife to be would say to her young husband to be. She said, "When we come back from our honeymoon, what are you going to do?" And I said, "Well, I said, I think I'm maybe going to try to be a writer. I mean, I could have said I was going to be a small engine repairman. She said, oh, be a writer. She said, that's great. She said, I'll get a job and go to work and you stay home and write. And that's exactly what we've done for 58 years.
58 years married.
Yes.
What it's really, really striking is that, like, you write about divorce so much in your fiction. And yes, it stands in stark contrast to this amazing marriage and life that you've shared, the stability, yes, of the amazing life and marriage that you've shared. What's been the secret to the success of
I married the right girl. That's been the secret to that success. I mean, look, I mean, she's way smarter than I am. She has a more balanced point of view than my point of view. She has an equanimity, which is amazing, and she gets the joke. And frankly, she likes men.
Which is a good thing.
It's a good thing for me. It's a good thing for all my friends who are kind of naughty boys and, not always walking the straight and narrow. She just kind of likes that.
Can I talk to you about this stage of your life, both through the novel, which is the fifth and final, although you said that about Independence Day. So,
well, I thought that. Every time I said it, it was because I thought it.
But has concluding the series and moving back home to your roots, do you feel you're on a bit of a sense of a homecoming, both in your professional as well as your personal life?
Well, I don't know. But I know moving back to New Orleans after living in Maine for 25 years has been something that Christina and I both wanted to do. I mean, I'm great friends with my high school buddies, and I actually love seeing my high school friends. Christina yesterday in New Orleans went out to lunch with friends of mine from high school, and there's just something about the through line there, because my life has gone far away from where I began. And for me, there's something very, more than comforting, there's something heartening about seeing where you came from and where you got to, and that somehow or other you are a version of the same person that you recognize. I would hate to get out to the end of my life and think to myself, gee, I've become a whole other man. That would dismay me, I think.
And obviously, speaking of your origins, obviously we are very proud to claim you. But do you look back now just about your parents, the life that they led, and reflect on how that has shaped your life and your outlook on life?
Well, I wrote a little book a few years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, called Between Them, which is about my parents. My parents were wonderful. They loved me. They took good care of me. I think really importantly, because they were married 15 years before they figured out how to have a baby, I think. I don't think they had a clue. But they were both from Arkansas, which is probably, if you're from Ireland, it's not a place you think of very much. Although all of my family is Irish, and they all went from County Cavan to Arkansas, so there is kind of a line there. But my parents, I think, because they were married as long as they were, I think they loved each other maybe more in a not competitive way than they loved me. They certainly loved each other first. And that, for me, was a great fact of life. I could see my parents caring about each other and think to myself, I fit in here not in a subordinated way, but as the third. And it never made me feel isolated. It never made me feel unloved, because I was not unloved.
A question I always love to ask writers is, what's your process? And just because this is allegedly the last of the Frank Bascombe novels, you're not putting the pen down. Is it a compulsion? Do you just write every single day? Is it pen and paper? Have you adopted technology? Give us a little insight.
It's pen and paper.
Still.
It's not on a computer. And I write every day unless I don't. Put it that way.
What makes you not write?
I'm
schedule.
I'm tired. I'm bored. Yeah. I have something better to do. I'll go fishing, or I'll go bird shooting. I'll do all those things. I mean, I guess the important thing about one's vocation, if you're a writer, then it's a vocation, is that your writing life has to fit in on the same track as your lived life every day, your married life, your whatever else you're doing. And so that is the cornerstone of my writing life, which is to say, what I do fits into my life. It doesn't dominate it.
Well, I don't know how much writing you're going to get in over the next month, because I know you're at the you're in Merrion Square tonight, and next month you will be Listowel, Belfast, Barris, Kells and Kennys. You've got a huge schedule ahead, but and I know you're also at Dalkey as well, so lots of your fans are going to get the chance to see you in person. But it has been my privilege to chat to you this morning.
Great pleasure.
Richard Ford, I hope we're back here in 10 years with another instalment of Frank Bascombe, but for now, thank you, and we're going to take a quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.